strength of Australia has always been not just in the cities, but in those regions. A lot of innovation comes out of those regions. A lot of ability to take risk comes out of those regions. And there's some of the things we're missing now out of the cities.
Welcome to Nowscast, a podcast from Nous Group. I'm Tanya Smith, a principal of Nous. For our first-time listeners, we are an award-winning, Australian-owned management consulting firm. This year, Nous is celebrating its 20th anniversary. To mark the occasion, we've launched Beyond 2020, an event series that will explore the big ideas shaping Australia's future, featuring leading thinkers from Australia and around the world. You'll be able to catch each of these discussions right here on Nowscast. In this episode, we identify the core challenges facing our regional communities, and we ask the question, what does the future hold for regional Australia? Australia's regional and rural areas are dealing with some of the greatest economic, social, and environmental challenges, but people from those areas would be quick to point out too that they offer tremendous untapped potential. Regional communities are a big part of our current and future prosperity, and they embody much of the Australian character. Our farmlands and country towns are as much a feature of our national self-image as Bondi Beach or Melbourne's laneways. But the images we more often associate with regional Australia these days are those of business closures, natural disasters, services in retreat, disenchanted youth looking for opportunities that only seem available in the cities, and of course, angry voters who feel their concerns are not being heard. Here, we discuss the challenges faced by regional communities and explore what governments at all levels can and should do to promote a more secure, inclusive and prosperous future for those Australians who live outside the big cities. The discussion you'll hear today is one I hosted with a range of experts and those who bring lived experience of regional Australia. Our guests are Dr. Rachel Bacon, Deputy Secretary for the Regional and Territories Group at the Commonwealth Department of Infrastructure, Regional Development and Cities; Councillor Jenny Hill, Mayor of Townsville in Queensland; and Dr. Rebecca Huntley, author and principal at social research firm Vox Populi Research. My colleagues, Simon Smith, principal at Nous Group and former New South Wales Departmental Secretary, and Dr. Prinz Rolston, principal and leader of the Queensland practice at Nous Group, also participated and offered their own well-informed perspectives. I hope you enjoy it. So, Rebecca, I'm going to ask you to set the scene a little bit for us, if you don't mind. Yep. You obviously do a lot of detailed research with people all around the country, and you sit around kitchen tables and having cups of tea and lots of scones, I hear, with people in regional Australia. So can you just give us a bit of an overview about what's most important for them and what do you hear about their needs and their expectations?
Yes, okay. I suppose the question, what do people in regional Australia want, is only a question that people who live in the centre of big cities ask. Because I kind of go, well, what part of regional Australia? And, you know, Tanya, you very usefully shared that kind of five-stage segmentation that you use about different kinds of regional Australia, their needs and expectations. And it isn't just about size, but it's very much in my experience about driving proximity to a place where you might be able to find a job. Do you feel that your community is getting bigger or contracting in some way? Or in even it can stay the same and it can still feel like it's closing in. At a qualitative level, you know, you go to places in regional Australia where we say, what's the big issue? And they say the biggest issue is we have to drive to see a GP, and there's a real issue with ice addiction and with where we send our parents when we can't care for them anymore. Is there a decent, you know, retirement living? So there's a combination of size, proximity to options and other choices, and there's a whole range of, obviously, jobs is absolutely critical, but social infrastructure. And so you can be in some part of even just one state, you can be in a, you know, some part of one state and it feels like there's an extraordinary future here. And then you can drive 4 or 5 hours and it's very different. So, but if I was to really generalize about what are the common things that come up. One of them is health and health infrastructure. Mm. It's always, I was in Albury, Wodonga about 18 months ago, that had a new cancer center there that had been, well, they thought it was new, but it had been there for a while. It was just incredible how just one piece of the health puzzle had really opened up, kind of alleviated pressure in that area around a whole lot of other things. I mean, they were still having issues around things like mental health infrastructure or early, issues around early childhood intervention for kids with behavioural issues or hearing issues. But something like that really, it can lift a regional area in the way that a really, really good local public school, high school can. Mm. And if the job mix is all right, then suddenly you feel like everybody feels like this is a place where I could be. So health is important and jobs. Jobs is really critical. The very consistent thing I got in groups that I was doing across Australia was the mixed blessing of a workforce that was flying in and flying out.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't really matter that they were getting reasonably good wages if they were flying in and flying out. There was very much this sense of, well, what does that mean to the community on the ground? Yes, they'd be spending, but what's happening to how kind of where's the longevity of that? Where's the ability for able to build up the community? And then the other thing you get to if you go to a place like Bendigo or even Ballarat is they'll say, yeah, there's a lot of people here, but not during the week. They're kind of going back and forth to Melbourne and they're coming here for their walking around and feeling like they're country folk, but they're not actually, and they're living here, but they kind of feel like during the day their town is a ghost town.
That's great. So we'll come back to some of the issues that you raised about services in particular and just kind of commitment to the community. But I'm interested first, Rachel, in hearing from you too about, well, how does the Australian government think about this? I mean, you've got such a wide remit and there's a lot of regional Australia to deal with. How do you approach thinking about where you invest your time and effort and what specific levers that you would think are most effective from your
point they're
of view?
Really good questions, and maybe just building a bit on what Rebecca's talking about in terms of what feedback are we hearing. We've had a number of reports and inquiries. We've had parliamentary committee inquiries. We've had productivity commission inquiries. We've recently done an expert panel exercise. Hundreds of submissions and people coming and talking to various inquiries. We've also kind of been on the ground doing quite a bit of outreach in local communities as part of the drought programs that we've been delivering. So actually talking to farmers who might need assistance and facilitating that, kind of literally going around in a bus with a number of different service providers together to communities to facilitate kind of access to government and the conversations that come from that. We're lucky enough to support the National Local Government Awards. So as part of the Local Government National General Assembly the other month had, 540-odd local governments in town kind of all talking to us, to ministers, et cetera, about issues in their local government areas and for their communities. We've had our ministers sit down with BCA members, and talk to them about regionally locating and what are some of the barriers and challenges. I've just come back last night from 5 days at Garma, so listening to a lot of senior elders and local Aboriginal people from East Arnhem Land and other places around Australia as well, just talking about what it means to do very local economic development in really remote communities for some of those communities, for example. And the interesting thing that triangulates, like there are some things that are triangulating from all of those sources of input that government's getting, and then our ministers in their electorates are talking to people as well. So it's kind of a whole lot of input. Some of the things that we're noticing are really starting to triangulate. There's probably 3 or 4 themes that are coming out in what we're seeing. The first is communities saying you need to listen to us, and communities saying you actually need to have conversations with us and listen to what our priorities are, and we want to collaborate. So, and that's not going to be for every community, but, certainly over the last several days up in East Arnhem Land, overwhelmingly people were saying, we can only achieve the things that we would like to achieve for our kids if we're collaborating and partnering with government, with businesses, with local governments, with communities, etc. So that sense of listen to us and listen to our priorities, because the priorities in every region are different, the natural advantages are different, the challenges are different, and so listen to us. because we know, you know, our local area. So, and for a national government, that comes with a set of challenges about what are the vehicles to create opportunities to sit down and listen to very small communities when there are, you know, thousands of them across the country. Another theme that's coming out really strongly, and we're hearing that very loud and clear, is we want different levels of government to join up. We don't want this government, you know, giving grant programs over here and a different level of government doing something different over here. We want you to join yourselves up and kind of, you know, engage with it in a joined up way. And the other message is we want portfolios across governments to join up. So in other words, in the Commonwealth government, where we've got employment, infrastructure, social services, it's state governments delivering health, education, et cetera, all of the things that are important levers for communities in terms of social and economic outcomes, the feedback is we want you to join that up and not do, again, a bit over here that's not connected to a bit over here and that we're getting perverse outcomes because you're duplicating or there are gaps. And interestingly, I've been quite struck by three of the themes that are commonly recurring and kind of starting to triangulate about what do we need to support vibrant regional communities. And the three that I'm picking out, and this is from kind of the large corporates and the local government from right in the southern part of Victoria and kind of everything in between, it's connectivity, so digital physical connectivity, it's skills and amenity. Do we have a decent hospital for our kids? Do we have somewhere we can get to the GP? Do we have a good school for our children and so on? So those things are really triangulating in some of the feedback that we're seeing. And in terms of what we're doing about that, you know, what's the Australian government doing? There is actually a lot of interest, a really strong investment in regional Australia. So if you look at, for example, the regional budget statement that was part of the budget papers, I think we had almost 600 different initiatives that were being funded across different portfolios across government for regional Australia. They're in part of the potential challenge there around how do you join that up. So there's a lot of investment. There are a lot of different initiatives. The other thing we're seeing, though, and when I talk to my counterparts in different portfolios across the Commonwealth, is a lot of people are talking about how do we take regional approaches to investment or regional approaches to design and delivery. And we've got different pilots that are going on around the place. So, for example, the Australian government has worked on three pilot regional deals, and the Barkly regional deal in the Northern Territory, which was signed a few months ago, is, I think, a good model of, you know, what a regional deal can look like. So there are those pilots happening. The Department of Social Services is trialling approaches around collective impact in 10 particularly disadvantaged regional communities. And, you know, we're seeing employment trials, empowered communities is another initiative. So we're kind of seeing across a range of portfolios, things are there's almost a desire or kind of an intuitive understanding that if we can take regional approaches for certain things, then we may get better outcomes. And, you know, we think that with the grant programs, for example, that a lot of us do in regional Australia, that there's something very complementary there between grants that may fill, you know, a particular gap at a particular point in time and make a real impact on a small community. And there's lots of examples of that, but also something about this regional approach, which takes an extra effort and extra investment, but potentially for the right things, whether that's in tackling really entrenched disadvantage or really trying to build sustainable economic development, which needs, I think, quite a lot of community buy-in. For certain things, you know, those regional approaches potentially make a lot of sense. So that's something that there's a lot of conversation about at the moment.
Yeah, thank you. So Simon, you've been just thinking about your experience in state government and more recently doing some work around regional development, a lot of the themes that Rachel's just talked about would sound pretty familiar, I imagine. There's some elements of that would be particularly new. You know, we want joined up government, we want you to listen to us and so on. Nevertheless, very important. But are you seeing anything different and interesting in the way governments, particularly in your experience, are starting to think about the regional challenges that we've been touching on?
Yeah, quite a few things. So one struggle, I think, is always the tension between not wanting to leave any particular community behind versus using money wisely to create opportunity. Mm. And so we've been doing some work on saying, well, at one level, you know, any sovereign jurisdiction can't abandon any part of its territory, no matter how dire its economic prospects may be. So a commitment to certain maintenance of certain basic services is got to be part of the response. But also an observation that there's quite a lot of internal migration between different regional areas and people making choices about where they want to live. So particularly now that people have more mobility, they can travel further with a car and their expectations are higher. They want access to more health services or job opportunities, like a good job opportunity for both people in a couple, for example, you know, not enough to just have one person who gets a good job, and also wanting to manage the risk of if you're falling out of a job that there might be something else to go to, you know, if you're putting down roots and so forth. So definitely migration from smaller places to larger regional places, an attraction to where the government is going to invest to support growth, economic development, to try to align with the growth patterns that already exist. So if everyone's, you know, growing towards certain places because it represents lifestyles that they want to live or economic opportunities that exist, we'll go with that. You know, don't try to say, oh, well, they're okay, they're growing, so they don't need any help. And to go and try to pin up the place where there isn't a fundamental economic opportunity, I think, is a mistake. So the hard thing is, how do you craft a framework that enables political leaders to eyeball their electorates, talk honestly, but use taxpayers' funds wisely. So we did a bit of work looking to say, how much does the state government spend per capita across all of the things that it does in different geographies across the jurisdiction? And I think the state in New South Wales was spending about 10 times as much per person on providing services in the most remote regions as it is compared to those right in the CBD. But, of course, the people in those regions were experiencing a much lower level of opportunity because it's just so expensive to provide services to small dispersed populations. So, you know, if the truth were known and that was out in public domain, then probably the taxpayers in the city would say, well, how come we're giving so much subsidy to all the people in the regions? The people in the regions are saying, well, how come we're getting such poor service compared to what everyone else gets? So, like, there's a terrible tyranny on all of that, and funds are scarce. So I suppose the first level is sort of committing to basic services. Second is supporting growth that's already underway. And then I'd say the third is to better understand and work with local communities on what are their strengths, what are their competitive advantages, and to be really quite precise about all of that, and to identify, you know, better to do things that will unlock or overcome a specific barrier or something that's holding a region back due to the absence of a particular thing, rather than a kind of white elephant, build it and they will come, hope, like you saw in the WA with their royalties for regions, you know, this dispersal of massive amount of funds, building all this stuff that might, you know, shiny on the day, but probably so expensive that the community can't even afford to look after it and make good use of it. So I'm thinking what I'm seeing is a kind of slowly evolving ability to provide a framework that is sufficient for political leaders to deal honestly, respectfully, and compassionately with all of the places in their jurisdiction, but also has a kind of economic logic to it that will use scarce funds most wisely.
Are you saying that we're getting to the point where we will need to say to some smaller towns that your destiny is pretty much set in stone?
Well, you probably never would say that. But you might, but you should, but you, every time a government spends money on something, it's not available to spend on something else. And so I think it's important to be able to talk about the positive opportunities in the regions which are manifest and to support those things that will clearly deliver substantial value.
Mm. I suppose this is where making sure that there are forums for the community to have that community-wide discussion about what that future looks like, rather than having that dictated to them.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not talking about saying, well, favouring one whole region against another. Mm. It's more typically, well, what are you going to do within a region?
Mm.
You know, where I come from in New South Wales, you know, we might be looking at the Central Tablelands area. There's a number of small or large towns, small cities or whatever, and they've all got different prospects and strengths and so forth. And then there are little tiny places that are in between those or satellites of those. And the movement's very clear. People are migrating into the bigger places, and some of them are much stronger than others, and some of them need different things than others. So.
Jenny, you've been very patient. As we've been talking about your daily challenge of trying to manage change within a region and attract investment.
Yeah.
How do you respond to this? Does it gel with you?
anyone who lives north of the Tropic of Capricorn, you've got 1 million people in a third to nearly half of Australia. And local councils in Queensland are different to local councils in Sydney. I've got a $5 billion worth of assets under management. We work as regions of councils, so we actually work as quite big regions to deal with Canberra and deal with some of the issues. I want to go back to the Building Regions program out of WA. When I was acting president of the LGAQ in Queensland, we saw that the theory of that was a good idea. So we encouraged the government, the Palaszczuk government, to look at a Works for Queensland program. So that program has worked really well, where it directly funds local governments outside the SEQ to allow us to develop and build with local unemployed people, either the renewal of assets or the provision of new assets. Now, that would have to be one of the most popular programs in local government, and it also helps us to deal with the issue around renewal of assets. And I would strongly suggest government needs to look at that, because that has been a godsend for local governments from Toowoomba up to TI.
Is there something different about your model which has avoided the white elephant problem?
Yeah, it really is about the government allows us to renew assets. So the biggest problem for local governments with shrinking populations and shrinking rate base is the ability to deal with depreciation. So by providing that money based around a framework of unemployed, the deal is you have got to employ unemployed people. You've got to train them. You've got to deal with it. So it actually starts to put people in a cycle of work, as well as allow you to renew assets. Now, I've got to tell you, in Townsville, from about after Q&I closed, Queensland Nickel, and we won't mention that, we had unemployment spike to around about 13%, and we had youth unemployment at around about 25%. Indigenous unemployment in our community would probably be around about 25%. So that initially helped us start to at least corral and get people trained. Now, you can't sit on your hands and expect governments, federal or state, to do much more than that. So we've had a program of looking at changing the economy of Townsville. And at the moment, one of the things we have is land. We've got plenty of land in regional Australia. And I'm sorry, I don't consider Bendigo or Ballarat regional Australia, because I grew up in Melbourne. I went to uni in Melbourne. I mean, for me, Bendigo and Ballarat are the outer suburbs of Melbourne now. Same as Geelong.
So is Wollongong and yeah, Newcastle.
They really are, because of the way the transport models are. Yeah. But for the rest of us north of Brisbane, I'm closer to Port Moresby than I am to Brisbane. So, and we've got really good links into Papua New Guinea of all places. But that's because of the people movement that occurred at the times. So for us, it's about how do we change our economy and create something that will build real jobs. So we had land. We had the Adani situation. We allowed that because our community needed hope. So we supported Adani, and to this day, they are supporting us with jobs at the moment. Around that, though, we know that we've got to transition people out of those jobs into the new economy. So governments talk about it and no one believes them. So we're not talking about it, we're just doing it. So we're working with Bill Moss, Magnus Australia, C4V, Eastman, Kodak Eastman, and we're quickly moving towards building Australia's first lithium-ion battery plant that'll be run out of renewable energy. Now, you've got to take a punch. You've got to take a risk. And we as a local government have taken a risk. And on the back of that, there's about four or five other industries that now want to come into that same area. So it's about, everyone says to me, you can't have advanced manufacturing in Australia anymore. And I reckon that's a crock, an absolute crock. I think it's about how we look at what we can do in the rest of Australia. And sadly, everyone thinks about Melbourne and Sydney. they don't really see that we can do these things in the region. We can implement the new technologies. We have the flexibility to be able to manoeuvre and to, I think, we'll be able to live to deliver not just my city in the region, but actually for the rest of Australia.
I just wanted to make a follow-up comment about that. I think what's really clear is when is that this language around transitioning to a new economy is really problematic when it kind of hits the road with people because there are so many questions, because in so many ways economic transition has meant their communities have gotten smaller and people have lost jobs and not be able to get them back. And this is particularly the case in regional Australia. You'll meet somebody who, you know, a couple where, thank God, she had a job with a local government or as is a nurse, because that family would go under because the guy loses his job in his early 40s and will never get another one, probably. And the social impact of that is huge. So I think we have a lot of, it's really interesting you say talking about it, I just think increases cynicism. People need actual examples in their community where government have come together with business and the community to bring about a local solution. And then just one final thing, Deakin and Griffith released a couple of weeks ago, you can go on it, kind of 100 jobs of the future in Australia. And I went through that list. Other than agriculture, I wondered whether our policymakers would have a solution or a or kind of some kind of framework about could those 100 jobs be done in any part of Australia? Do they all have to be done out of
Sydney? I've seen those lists before, all right? But it really is about who's got the drive to understand what are the technologies for the future and how do we bring them back into the country? And most importantly for me, it's about bringing them back into the regions. There are some real difficulties for the cities over the next 20 years, particularly around water. Yet I live in a region now, thanks to the federal government, I can pipe the water that I want, that I'm going to be able to create a city that will not have a water problem for up to 1 million people. But can I get 1 million people living in my city in the next 20 years? Well, unless government policy changes, it's going to be really difficult.
What specifically about government policy?
There are issues, fundamental issues around education. So the government policy around universities tends to help the sandstones, not the regionals. So I lost both my children to Brisbane because they couldn't be educated in the courses they wanted in Townsville. Now, that happens to a lot of people. So it's about, are you going to continue to fund or allow the sandstones to fund the way they are, or are you going to invest in the regions? Because that starts to pull the younger generation back into the regions, which is what we desperately need.
But can I just also make the point about, Rebecca, the list of the categories of kind of skills or jobs in the future? I think the kind of thing that Jenny is doing in Townsville of seeing an opportunity and your local leadership in places to see an opportunity, partner, and then do something, unexpected in remote places. So one of the presentations that I saw when I was up in East Arnhem over the weekend on Groote Island, which is, kind of as remote as you can get in Australia. So the local community in Groote Island have partnered with a leading kind of Melbourne furniture designer to create Manapan furniture, which is manufactured on Groote Island by local Aboriginal people, and the kids are getting trained and they've set up a workshop and, they've won the Melbourne Design Award. They've been off to Milan showing their furniture. And you wouldn't necessarily say, oh, Groote Island, that'd be a good place to, from the skills that you need in the future, let's do kind of cutting edge design in Groote Island. And there are all kinds of examples when you go to small communities. And the ingredients that I think make that really hard for government, particularly a national government, is it's often local leaders who are taking the initiative, seizing an opportunity and just really innovating and doing amazing things. And we don't talk about those examples enough, I think.
I mean, with this list, I went through it. I didn't think that any of them couldn't be done in regional Australia. I was just wondering what's the plan around it, because it came across as something where future jobs, and we tend to associate that with kind of concentrations of people and, educational infrastructure and all the rest of it. And so Yeah, and I also think that that just can often convey to people who are living in regional Australia and want to stay there that they don't have a place in this sparkly new economy that's transitioning in this direction. So we've got to do something about that.
So Prinz, that great example that we just heard about from Rachel is terrific because it not only is creating jobs, but it's also addressing some issues of social inclusion and just improving opportunities for the Aboriginal community there more generally. How do you scale up those sorts of things? Is it about fostering a whole lot of innovations like that, or is it about scaling them up, or both? Or what's the recipe from your point of view?
Growing up, for example, in Gove in the 70s, or Nullumboy, and Yirrkala, and then watching how the various communities in the remote areas have gone through the period, you see flashes that come through in terms of little businesses start up, and they're great. Some of them go well and others don't. So, for example, I set up the first ICT incubator in the Territory. Out of Darwin, went great for 5 years, died soon after. What drives those sorts of activities and the sentiment is really about how empowered those communities feel and what's actually happening in those communities. The range of services that get delivered to communities and, for example, I'm working with a particular community southwest of Weipa called Napranum, and in that community they asked us to come in and help them develop up a service model that would help them get over all of the different barriers. You know, they had 1,000 people, education issues, employment issues, the whole lot. And they had every service you could imagine got hosed into that community, whether it was health, education, all of these different services at a point in time got hosed off, hosed in, and turned off at a regular interval. This is a pattern for those communities that have happened certainly in my lifetime over, you know, from the 1970s all the way through to now. The challenge, and this is where these, as Rachel was indicating, these communities are now getting empowered themselves.
Are they taking the power, Prinz, or yeah, are they?
They're taking being the given power. It. So the pretense is that they've always had the power, and when you actually have services delivered by fly-in, fly-out, and monies attached to various things, you're disempowered. You know, that's where it comes to. So the empowerment happens when they decide that we'll choose and we'll get what it is that we need for our community, and we actually understand what that looks like. But also, for example, with this community that we're working with, they've struck a 7-year deal in terms of the service. So not 1 year, not 3 years. It's 7 years in terms of that's the shortest generational change. There are communities, whether they're Aboriginal communities and Torres Strait Island communities, or working with Jenny and the Townsville City Council, it's communities in those areas that are also saying, hang on, you know, we want to take charge and we actually want what it is that will make us different. Whether on Groote Island they're doing furniture manufacturing or other economic activation issue, that's I guess the sentiment in those regions. And why is it that we need services, and why is it that we need jobs, and we need to be engaged in these processes, is because they see themselves as the resource base. That's where they see the future of Australia. And so the political impact, say for example from the federal sphere, they feel empowered through that process to keep pushing those issues forward, whether it's jobs, health, education. The primary basic things are what they're after.
Can I just comment?
Yeah, sure.
To draw something just that a few people have commented on, I just think, so in the big city, thinking about the big clustering of people, just the realities of delivering services for the community are such that the scale is big. And it makes sense to specialise by the line of service that you're going to do. So you think about, you know, like health services or education services, you just tend to specialise by type. But the further you get away from big population centres, there's just a fundamental logic where it all becomes about place, you know, like in every domain. Like it's about even the businesses have to provide multiple types of businesses because there's just not that many. You can't afford to have very specialised businesses, so you have people who do clusters of things. And I just think there's a real logic about these kind of deals that are emerging in a couple of frameworks where government comes together to address a place and tries to sort out, okay, well, we were going to send this much money anyway. Let's just work out what it should be used for. It doesn't matter which bucket it's come out of from the central treasury pot, but just to have these, like, I think those things are good for empowerment, but they also just make good economic sense.
You're talking about city deals?
Well, even just logically. Like, so even, yes, but smaller things. So, for example, some work we're involved with in, say, in smaller regional towns, every department that owned buildings had its own separate contract for the maintenance of all those buildings. And that was just like, duh. And so the deal was, okay, well, everyone's going to pull the maintenance money and we'll let one contract to a local provider with some strings about skills development, et cetera. And everyone goes, well, why was that so hard? But I know that in Canberra it's going to be really hard given all of the legal frameworks that say, well, the parliament passes the money, divides it up amongst the programs, you know, the social security entitlements, the support for schools, all of the rest of it. The machinery to make that come together at a place level is a really big policy priority in my view.
Just on the point about demography, how easy or hard is it to get a uniform view from a region about what it is that the people there want? To what extent is demographic changes making it more difficult to meet current needs but also anticipate future needs, given that there is a fair bit of mobility going on and a fair bit of demographic change, I think? What sort of dynamic does that bring to the challenge?
Well, I think Jenny kind of mentioned it. Like, how do you keep people there in their 20s, 30s and early 40s? That's a kind of critical place. And you will go to a place where, you know, there's a lot of people under 18 and there might be people in those age groups, but they might be trapped in chronic unemployment, and then you've got an ageing population. Now, we know that in some parts of regional Australia there's a genuine skill shortage to even care for the older population as well in ways that are sustainable and appropriate. So, yeah, you do get a real sense that you're in a place where the people in their 20s, 30s and 40s have left either to study or get work or do something else, and you just wonder what will bring them back even if they want to come back.
So interests are broadly aligned, you think, between?
It's different for us because we've got Australia's biggest military base. So our population's skewed. So under 40, our average age is actually 34.2. It's one of the youngest averages in Australia. And fundamentally, during the age brackets, believe it or not, of from about 20 to about 35, there are more men than women. So it does sometimes make it easier to recruit females to come up. Just saying. But that has...
Is that an advertisement?
I'm hopeful. I need more skilled people. But it's about we have the opportunity to keep those people in our population, and that's one of the things we're going to work toward. I think there's a real battle for regional Australia. So I know every mayor right out to Mount Isa and all the way up, Ernie, right up to the Gulf Country. And TI. In fact, I'll be in TI next week. So we have a really good cluster of people. For us, the big thing is how do we get young people back into the regions? So we've been talking about, you start to need to think about, at least on the East Coast, because you've got some economies there. What are you going to do in Cairns? What are you going to do in Townsville, Mackay and Rockhampton? And can we grow those centres and then push them back out west, so that it's really hard for people to get from Julia Creek to Brisbane. So the mayor of Julia Creek, her daughter's been accepted into the youth ballet in Brisbane. So it's a real difficulty for her to get her daughter from there to Brizzy.
So you're talking about creating more northern Bendigos and Ballarats,
yeah,
in,
well,
Queensland?
Literally doing that. And starting to move the population, because from what I've read and what I've started to see, the cluster within Melbourne and Sydney particularly, and I think the same thing will happen to Brisbane, it's just going to become one urban landscape that will suck everything if you let it. And the strength of Australia has always been not just in the cities but in those regions. A lot of innovation comes out of those regions. A lot of ability to take risk comes out of those regions. And there's some of the things we're missing now out of the cities. If you're going to have a strong economy and a strong, resilient population, the regions really are important.
Because I think the other part there is in those cities, the investments that are going into sort of the Penrith's in those strips. So, for example, in Brisbane, the strip from Toowoomba down to the Gold Coast, the amount of money that's going in to address disadvantage, I would challenge, would be much more than what's going into the regions, because the unemployment, the crime rates, all of those activities in those strips are so significant. And shifting some of that population, not an easy thing, but into the regions is one of the issues, and that's happening in Melbourne West, as well as in that train down from the sort of Blue Mountains into Penrith and through that all the way through to Fairfield and so forth. But those strips are, you know, either you allow those strips to grow and you invest lots of social capital into trying to address those issues, or is there an alternative in terms of those particular strips?
Don't want to be the negative voice, but there are definitely huge strengths of agglomerations of a certain size. Like, cities can be too big, but they can also be way too small. Mm-hmm. And it's really worth focusing on the ones that are just big enough, I think, to offer lots of prospects for people. You know, not to be nostalgic about the life people chose or required to live in the past.
The challenge there is that, you know, the demographic information says that a city is self-sustaining when it gets to 300,000 people. And the challenge for us is you draw that line from the Sunshine Coast down to Perth, and the only city that's anywhere near that is Townsville, you know, and that's it. So in terms of coming up to that size, that's our challenge, is how do you get it to?
Yeah, so I just say, well, then you should focus on Townsville, or, you know, you should focus on
Don't tell Cairns that.
That's the reality, isn't it? Everyone wants a prize, and every politician wants to give everyone in their electorate a prize, and there's a dissipation of it.
But there's also the thought of national security. I tell the Chinese they could put 1 million people near the Ord River and no one would notice.
And I'm more of an optimist than Simon.
Right.
I do wonder, you know, with increasing rapidity and technological change, I mean, you know, the internet hasn't been around for that long. The way that, you know, different business opportunities might be constructed, the kind of increasing pressures in highly densely populated, you know, cities that, you know, we see data around, you know, fathers in Melbourne living in the outer suburbs spending more time commuting than with their kids. You know, I do wonder, while we've seen agglomeration, you know, just as this trend, one-way trend, I do wonder if there'll be a tipping point at some point where more might want, you know, the sea change, the tree change, whatever it is, the shows back on television.
Australia, if you look at the size of our cities, it's a weird, weird country. We have so few really big cities. Nearly every other country has a much larger distribution of city sizes. Like, we're just kind of, and it just seems particularly odd given how much space we've got.
Rachel, I think you're right to some extent. I mean, we've done lots of research on asking people in the city why they don't, particularly people who are miserable, there's quite a lot of them, why? and the commuting thing is right. I remember it's one of the most profound stories I've heard from Australians in the last 15 years. This woman who'd been kind of reasonably well positioned in a bank and went and had 3 kids, and they were living in the outskirts of Melbourne. And she said, my husband has to leave work at 6 o'clock every morning to commute, and he can't, otherwise he just won't get to work on time. And so the kids aren't even awake, and then he's home at 7. And she said, so I'm thinking check out chick, because I actually can't take on a job that, you know, because he commutes and because this is his job, I have to take a completely different job so I can be there for the kids. And she was thought I'd get, you know, some money off groceries, so that'd be good. but I really would think about how people have to twist their decisions when they're living in the outer metropolitan areas. So we once did a big report asking people in the city why they don't move to their regions. And I think that the more people feel insecure, not just about jobs, but about a whole range of things. So the service is going to be there, and it happens at every stage of people's life, whether they've got young kids, whether they've got kids at high school, whether they are at that point where they're, you know, the level of job insecurity of people in their late 50s is also quite high. They know they have to work for another 10 years. They worry about leaving one job and starting in another and what that means. And then, so I think you're right, but I think we've got to think about, well, what is it that's going to make people jump? It isn't always just a job, although that's absolutely critical. It's like, what are the other pressures that they have in their life? And yes, there was a whole lot of interest and willingness, but a lot of insecurity around a lot of what will they be jumping to, and will I then be able to jump back if it's not sustainable?
It's an important point. Some thought-provoking points on the interdependence of government, business and local community initiative in both defining and realising a future for regional Australia. This work will be critical in the coming years as we weather significant changes from all directions. Our thanks to all our guests for sharing their insights with us today. And if you're interested in learning more about NAUS and our work, go to www.nausgroup.com or click the link in the show notes.